You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Taser International, the sole manufacturer of the tasers used by police departments in the United States, consistently claims that its products are non-lethal, despite the fact that there have been many reported taser-related deaths in this country. A documentary by Nick Berardini called Killing Them Safely looks into how tasers have changed policing practices since they were introduced and tries to determine who's responsible for a taser-related death when police officers are repeatedly told that they do no harm. The film opens at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village this Friday, and it'll also be available on VOD. I'm very pleased that it has brought Nick Berardini to our show today. Hello.
Hey, thank you for having me.
One of the subjects in your film is a man named Stanley Harlan of Moberly, Missouri. How did you learn about him?
Yeah, Stanley Harlan's case came to me as I was finishing my undergraduate degree at the University of Missouri. I happened to be a student reporter working for the NBC affiliate in town the night he died, and just like raced out there in the middle of the night, coincidentally. And stuck with that story as I was finishing up my coursework throughout the year and didn't have, you know, a real driving interest to go into TV news. I had assumed that I always wanted to be in filmmaking, and this presented itself to be an opportunity to make a film about this small town that had really become fractured over what happened. I had no idea that it would spiral into the behemoth that it eventually became, but that was really the genesis for the film.
Did Stanley Harlan display any sort of threatening behavior toward the police that night?
No, that's really what started to pique my curiosity toward the company. Even by the time that the criminal investigation was closed, what the special prosecutor had said was that there was no evidence in the training material of the officers that what happened to him could be possible. And there was really no dispute that what happened to him was that he was tasered in the chest for 31 seconds and died of cardiac arrest. I mean, everybody was pretty much on the same page about that. And so as I got more into their training, and as the officers during the civil case were deposed and admitted that he posed no physical threat, the question of, you know, how could this happen to somebody, what's the disconnect there, started to make me more curious about the only company really selling and training officers on how to use them.
How long have tasers been available to police departments?
They have been around in some fashion for roughly 40 years now. Jack Cover, the original inventor, was relatively unsuccessful, though, at selling them to departments for two big reasons. One was that they used to be fired by gunpowder, so they were regulated by the ATF as a firearm. And the other was that they just weren't practically that effective, especially against the very people it was idealistically going to be used on, the aggressive, motivated, violent offenders. And what the Smith brothers did, Rick and Tom Smith, who were the two founding brothers of Taser International, was they figured out a way to increase the power of the weapons to make them effective, and they did that sort of while facing bankruptcy. And I don't want to give too much of the film away, but you know, there clearly are some hypothetical consequences with that when they made that decision that they didn't think through.
Now, the original was called an air taser. Does that name really describe what goes on here? Isn't it designed to give an electric shock?
Yeah, it was initially called an air taser because the Smith brothers were the first ones who were able to figure out how to use compressed nitrogen to fire the weapons as opposed to gunpowder, and that allowed them to get away from ATF regulation. But it does deliver electric current through wires that shoot out of the weapon and attach into the body, and that's where the conducted electricity comes through. So air tasers are maybe a little misleading, but now they are commonly referred to either as the X26 or the X2, which is the newer model that has a backup shot along with it.
And they have increased power. So they're sending a lot of electricity into our bodies, and that's designed to kind of paralyze us for a moment?
Yeah, the idea, you know, and why the film is so interesting is because it's not really a clean-cut case of good guys and bad guys. I mean, their intentions in the beginning might have been altruistic. I would allow them that, you know, point of view. But what we watch as they evolve over the course of, you know, more than a decade, And in the wake of this collateral damage, what you're seeing is they didn't really know how to manage the effectiveness of the weapon because nobody really understands how electricity works underneath the skin. The two leading regulatory agencies for electricity, the Underwriters Lab and the International Electrotechnical Commission, don't really understand how it works. And because of that, it was more a game of not if the taser could kill people, but how often it would kill people. And that's what really became tragic as you watch the film evolve, is we're sort of turning this into then a cost-benefit analysis while forgetting that ultimately there are a lot of dead people who die in situations they shouldn't be put in jeopardy in because officers believe that the weapons can't kill.
How many people have died as a result?
Well, you know, again, that's part of the problem of use of force statistics in the United States is we don't really keep an accurate record. But estimates are now showing that it's up over 900 people in North America.
Wow.
And the problem with that also is in each case, it's difficult sometimes to determine because electricity doesn't leave the consistent biomarkers in an autopsy that, you know, a gunshot might, for example, or an electrocution, which would leave burns. These are not people who are dying from electrocution. These are often people who are either dying from metabolic acidosis because the weapon causes 19 muscle contractions a second. So over the course of 30 or 40 seconds of being tasered, your blood can become acidic. Or they're dying of ventricular fibrillation, which is essentially a cardiac arrest that is difficult to determine if the electricity itself is the cause.
And we've seen this happening here as well. A man in the Bronx died of cardiac arrest after he'd been shocked by a taser.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, I think that what's important to know is that the company, you know, is where the movie is so interesting and where dealing with them was so interesting is that their rhetoric is fascinating. I mean, this is a company that has perfected marketing and rhetoric, knowing that all they had to do was plant the idea that it was a debate, even though their own internal research is showing that these risks are you know, borne out into the field. All they had to do was plant the idea to the officer in training that it was a debate. And if the officers had loyalty to Taser International, because Taser International was so effective at marketing to them, at saying, we're on your side, the public is not on your side, they would tend to believe the company. They don't want to believe this company with a mission statement to protect truth and protect life is coming in there and misleading them.
And they claim that they've helped save up to 90,000 lives. So by comparison, those 900 lives seem relatively small.
Exactly, and that 90,000 lives number is patently absurd. I mean, you know, it's made up, basically. We look at in-custody deaths, and the estimates show about 1,500 people a year total die, including shootings. So that would mean before they were in business, we were looking at, you know, 15,000 people a year or something that were dying, because now they claim the number is up over 150,000 people. But it's something that sounds like it might be true. And so that's what the officers respond to. And there's not a lot of concrete data because, again, we don't keep track of use of force that can counter that. And that's the danger of one company controlling this message to law enforcement officers.
I'm speaking to Nick Berardini, the director of Killing Them Safely, which opens at the IFC Center, also will be available on video on demand this coming Friday. Well, didn't they test it before they sent it to market?
Unfortunately, no.
They tested it on themselves and on their families.
Right, and this is where the disconnect really comes into play. In training, and they trumpet this a lot, no one has ever died during a training exercise using a taser. But the training is specifically designed to be as safe as possible. You know, naturally, that's the way it works with anything. So
it's meant to be a compliance tool.
Right. What happens is that they take these officers in training, they shoot them in the back, oftentimes for less than 5 seconds, and that way they can experience the pain of it and how it feels. But there are no restrictions that are required, that are, you know, that are actually put in. It's up to the departments to write their own policies with taser's information that they're giving them. And so there are no real restrictions usually about how often somebody can be tasered. So the training experience is completely different than the way the weapons are used in the field. And it's those extended durations that for a very long time, you know, only in the past few years have really been warned about, but for a very long time we're never even acknowledged or warned about the risks of those, you know, extended durations, which can be very dangerous.
In counties where police are also armed with tasers, does it make it less likely that a police officer will use a gun?
No, you know, what was important for us was to not necessarily, I wanted to make this movie about the men behind the decisions and not just a debate about how to use tasers. So we don't get too far into this, but quite honestly, I've never seen any research over an extended period of time that shows a significant reduction in deadly force with officers who use tasers. Now, what the company will claim is that injuries to suspects and to officers go down. And the injuries to officers definitely do go down, but that's because they're using them more frequently than anything else, and they're standing oftentimes at a 15-foot distance. Injuries to suspects is a bit misleading because we're not having to record or report the electricity going through the body as an injury. So even though it's very painful, there's no injury reporting requirement there oftentimes with departments. And that can be very misleading. In terms of deadly force, a lot of really good newspaper investigative journalists have tracked that, you know, for several different papers, and none that I've ever seen has shown that the deadly force actually goes down.
How did the police officers you talked to feel about tasers?
Many of them are conflicted. A number of them are very, very loyal. And the company, you know, at this point, this movie is sort of about how the victors write their own history, because tasers are not coming back en masse. And I think that would be a mistake to bring them back en masse, because so many officers are trained on these weapons and they've become somewhat reliant on these weapons. But the officers who have some bad experiences with them, whether that's someone who's severely injured, sometimes it's an officer in training who's injured, or, you know, they kill somebody in the field with them. The tragedy of this is that by the time anybody realizes what the actual consequences might be, it's too late. Someone is already injured or killed, and then we're retroactively sort of rewriting policies or rethinking the weapon's use in those individual departments. And I don't think that's the way it should be, obviously. The point of the film is, if anything, just to raise awareness with officers, to show them we're being thoughtful about your job and what it takes to do your job. Try to be thoughtful about not just what you're dealing with, but who you're dealing with, the men that are actually selling you this weapon.
Didn't the price of taser stocks shoot up in the wake of the Baltimore riots?
Yes. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that they're the market leader in body cameras now. And while body cameras aren't weapons, they're using the same rhetoric to sell body cameras that they sold tasers with. And that is essentially that the public is against you. The public, you know, will make these frivolous claims. They will try to, you know, claim excessive force. They will try to trap you, buy these body cameras to protect yourselves. And practically speaking, the departments respond to it because they want to look proactive to, you know, public strife. They want their, you know, citizens to think they're doing something proactive. But it helps deepen the divide that exists between between police officers and the communities they serve. All the while, this company is a weapons manufacturer. They have a vested interest in making sure that they are prioritized first. And what we don't know about body cameras yet, despite the rush to sort of put them on all these police officers, is how they're going to be stored, because Taser International controls a lot of the storage, and there's a significant upcharge for that. And who has access to that footage? That's something that really hasn't been thought out or borne out yet, but we're seeing this rush to put body cameras on officers in order to quell sort of public strife about use of force, and yet we don't have the practicality quite figured out yet.
Taser International announced today that it won a contract to outfit the London Metropolitan Police Force with body cameras. Now, you've written that our discussions about policing are failing in the United States. What's mm-hmm. been wrong about the discussions?
I think it becomes too easy to simplify a use of force scenario in order to use it as evidence. And what we do is we take the sort of last 30 seconds of somebody's life and an officer's decision making, and essentially use it to either mark the, you know, check the box of those who are defenders of law enforcement or those who would be critical of law enforcement. And the problem with that is that very few instances, obviously, are black and white. Many of them can be interpreted subjectively. And so what happens is now we're into this sort of shouting match, and the problem with that is that the officers then feel like the public doesn't understand their job, and the public doesn't, you know, feels that the officers or the departments are not responding and engaging, you know, in a way that's designed to protect people's lives. And so I think what we need to do is have a bit more of an evolved discussion about why this strife exists in the first place. How do we make departments more transparent? How do we make officers feel like the authority that we give them to use force is a responsibility, but one that we accept, one that we know has to be taken seriously? And I think that's critical, rather than instantly rushing to try to use these cases as evidence. We need to remember the humanity involved, definitely on both sides.
Now, in 2009, Taser International updated its training guides, saying that officers shouldn't aim for the chest. Where did they suggest they should aim for?
That's a good question. It's really about trying to figure out a way. This is part of the problem, is that they were trained to, these officers were trained to shoot center mass because that's the way they're trained on their guns. It was a seamless training. And the problem with that, of course, is that the danger that can exist when shooting someone in the chest is not really what the company is acknowledging. They're saying that to basically avoid liability while at the same time telling officers there's really still nothing to see here. It's just more about avoiding the controversy, as they put it. But what that does to the officer now is add a layer of decision making that he has to make in the field. And what they end up doing sometimes is either aiming lower and missing, or shooting people in the back, trying to get behind someone to shoot them in the back, which makes these weapons not really that effective for their intended purpose, which is a high-risk, volatile situation, you know, not necessarily where somebody is armed, but somebody is actively resisting and attacking, you know, the officers or someone else. If you're using the one-shot model, you can miss quite easily. And in fact, the police officers that we spoke to, when they were considering whether to keep tasers and just move them up the use of force continuum, decided ultimately that didn't make a lot of sense because 23% of the time they weren't getting the intended result they wanted, which meant that if they weren't going to be used in the high-risk scenarios, why justify the expense of buying them for all their street officers to begin with?
The Heston versus Taser case, which dealt with liability, was the first lawsuit that Taser International lost. What happened there?
Robert Heston, and now there's been several that they've lost or settled out of court, and you learn this sort of progression in the film. Everything that happens in the film is sort of an existential threat to the company because it's ultimately about the movies, the movie's about this company's sort of ability to try to justify its own existence. But starting with Heston, what we started to find in the public was that we could start identifying mechanisms of death. The company was very good, especially because the research was so sparse in the beginning, at sort of either feigning ignorance or downplaying what the mechanisms of death might be because they'd be difficult to determine. Heston was tasered for over a minute by three different officers and died of metabolic acidosis in combination with methamphetamine that he was on. So it was significant because the jury was saying, while we recognize that his drug use may have played a role in this death, the acidosis caused by the taser and caused by the pinning of the officers over that extended period of time also contributed to his death.
Well, does Taser International suggest that you taser somebody for a minute?
They do not suggest that, but they also don't restrict that. They want the officers to have to be able to make that judgment in the field as a part of a way to try to avoid liability. Again, companies, have to protect themselves first, And that's one of the ways they can make sure they don't get sued. If they tell an officer he can only use it for 10 seconds in the field, and he uses it for 8 seconds, and the suspect gets up and hurts the officer, the company will get sued. So they've very surreptitiously tried to sort of acknowledge that, you know, acidosis might be a thing, but don't let that, you know, impair your judgment in the field. And they're doing that in order to avoid any potential liability.
Has anybody done a study to determine whether in counties or countries where taser use has been dropped significantly that there's been an increase in officer or suspect deaths?
Yeah, and we kind of outline this again as we go throughout the film, toward the end of the film. The one I can specifically cite, you know, for sure is a big, broad, you know, really, really broadly scoped research development is in British Columbia. The use of tasers drops by about 83% in British Columbia after a really tragic incident in the airport in Vancouver, and there was no rise in suspect or officer injuries. Everything pretty much, you know, essentially remained the status quo, except for the fact that they were having less significant, you know, high-profile controversial deaths. In other studies, what we've seen is that the first year departments use tasers, the in-custody deaths can go up by as much as 600%, and that's because they're so eager to use them. They're so eager to, you know, they're so enamored with what the taser can do that they use it at very low levels of force and in dangerous manners. Now, what happens is people die, and then they peel back, you know, how they're using them and rewrite policies. But that's what I think can be really dangerous, is that without understanding the consequences, you become enamored with the best version, the best idea of what this technology can do, without really understanding what the consequences are.
Nick, do you know about whether New York City is buying tasers?
Yeah, New York City is actually now again doubling down, and they're spending about $4.5 million on new tasers and body cameras in response to what we've seen with the Walter Scott shooting, with Freddie Gray, with a lot of these incidents, because it looks proactive. And the public's idea of this weapon is still that it is an alternative to deadly force. That's what the company has done very, very well in terms of marketing. They pitch it as an alternative to deadly force to the public. But to police officers, who are the ones who are really the only ones who matter, they are pitching it as a weapon that can be used to end all confrontations. And so the appearance of doing something about, again, doing something about the strife is, let's buy more tasers and body cameras, and now we'll reduce deadly force and we'll hold officers accountable for their actions. In practicality, that's not really how it plays out.
Nick Berardini's film, Killing Them Safely, opens this Friday at the IFC Center and also will be available on video on demand. Thank you so much for being on our show.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.